Welcome to episode 4 of the Live Beyond podcast. This podcast is about people who step outside of their comfort zones to achieve some pretty amazing things, and I think really achieve their potential. They're people who inspire me and will hopefully inspire others. So I'm really excited to introduce my guest for this episode, a friend of mine called Melissa Fair. We actually recorded the podcast in her home, which is a boat on the River Thames. Pretty awesome. So from time to time, there is some background noise. Melissa is a runner, an entrepreneur, but also a survivor of a really serious bone marrow disorder and transplant. We talk about what she went through, but also her phenomenal achievements since her illness, both with regards to business and running, not least her world record from the World Transplant Games in Argentina this year. So awesome. So without further ado, here we go. Hi, Melissa.
Hello.
So I am really excited for a number of reasons. Melissa's a friend of mine, also from Random Crew. Firstly, we're sat on a boat on the River Thames in London, which is her house, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty normal for me, but everybody else seems to get very excited about it.
So I'm really excited about it. And also, super exciting, I'm sat with a running world record holder. So that's pretty cool as well, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to see how I'm just running along with people and then someone else goes, yeah, but tell them about Argentina. I'm like, so I won 6 gold medals for Great Britain and I broke a world record, and suddenly people's perception of you totally changes and they think that, like, oh no, I have to run properly and I have to run faster and I have to impress them. I'm like, no, it's really like, it's fine. So I kind of feel weird even telling people about it now. It's strange.
I can imagine, but it is pretty amazing. So do you want to talk about when that was this year and I suppose how you ended up there?
Yeah, so that was at the World Transplant Games, which were held in Mar del Plata, Argentina this year. And I found out the previous August, actually on the day I had just run Berlin Marathon. Okay. I got the email through for selection for Team GB, which was amazing. But I was like, I cannot process this after having just run a marathon. It's a bit too much. So yeah, there were, I think, about 200 members on Team GB. Everyone there has had either an organ or bone marrow transplant. So okay. Everybody competing, no matter what country they're from in the world, have all been saved by a donor. So that was like kind of the main criteria there. So being a runner, I competed in the longest running events they do, because I tend to be more of a half marathon or marathon runner. Yeah. But the longest they do is a 5K road race.
Ouch.
So yeah, it's brutally short and brutally fast. So that was the longest one I did. And then on the track for athletics, I did the 1500 meter, 800 meter, 400, and then the women's 4x400 relay as well. So again, brutally short. So it was completely different training. I trained for 8 months for it. I thought I might have a shot at the world record for the 5K or the 1500. Mm. But when we got down on the track, especially, it was so windy. It was really odd because there was no wind anywhere else in town that day. And then the athletics track was in, they had built it for like the Pan Am Games or something. So it was kind of like a Stratford Olympic Park set up. And as soon as you got into the park, it was just a wind tunnel in there. And so I was like, oh, the records are out the window. I might get gold because everybody else is running against the wind. Because you would come along the back straight and it was like I was running uphill. Like I was just straight into a wall. So, I came off the track after the 1500 and I was absolutely over the moon that I'd won. I got to cheer in one of my best friends, Ruth, who is a kidney transplantee that I've met at the British Games a few years back. Oh, she lovely. Also is a marathon runner. She's done 24-hour races. Like, she's full into the ultra scene as well. She's just really lovely. And she really, really fought, like, hard to win silver with an Iranian girl who got bronze. And I was like, oh, there's definitely no chance that I had a world record. And they didn't have the clock up, which is really odd. It's the first event where they didn't have a clock on the track. They do at all the British Games. And so for about a half hour, I was just like, oh, that was good, but I'm kind of disappointed in my time because it was just, yeah, it just wasn't what I wanted it to be because of the wind. And then I actually went up and looked at the posted times because I was keeping, I had had, this is so funny, For my whole 8 months of training, I'd had a little note in my phone that was times to beat. So for each of the events, it was the it was the gold time at the previous World Games.
Okay.
And my times for the last British Games. And if I think I even had like the previous British times from before I started running. And it wasn't until I went up and checked the results, put it into my phone, and then somebody asked me what time I got. And it was after that that I looked at it again, what I'd already written. I went, oh my God, that's a second faster than the world record time. And it was like a full half hour. And I went, I just broke a world record, and my shoe wasn't tied the entire way around. I double knot my shoes, but you can't stop on the track. It's not like a marathon where you can pull off to the side and tie your shoe. I just have to go with it. So yeah, I broke a world record.
So what does that feel like?
I don't even know. Like, it just seems a bit odd because I think also when people find out I have a world record, they kind of look at me and they're like, you don't look like you have a world record. Because like, I'm a strong runner, but I'm sturdily built. I'm a marathon, I'm a distance runner. I'm not a sprinter at all. And then I go, no, it's in a 1500 meter. And then they go, no, you're not at the Olympics. I'm like, no. I hold the fastest 1500 meter time for, actually, the world record is technically for the 30 to 39 year age range, but that's actually the fastest one of any of the age ranges. So
amazing. That's awesome.
So for any female transplant athlete. And actually, my 5K time from the road race, they don't do world records for the road race because they certify the length of them, but they can't, like, some of them it'll be slightly uphill. Other ones, obviously, a circulatory track will be different than if it's an out and back versus just a straight. So they can't really compare equally year on year. So they only do world's best times.
Okay.
And I got a world's best. I was first female across the line. And I think I was somewhere around, I was in the teens for total kind of men and women. So I was like the 14th or 16th
finisher. And that was a pretty fast time, your 5K.
Yeah, I did the 5K in 1904.
Yeah.
So that was a good PB for me because I don't normally run 5Ks. So over the summer I raced the Bupa 10K and the Nike Women's 10K. And so I basically did the first 5K of those all out, balls to the wall, try to see what a good time would be. And I was just hoping to get under 20 for those. Mm. And then, of course, I had to run another 5K after that. But
wow.
Yeah, it was entertaining. And just the camaraderie at the Games was absolutely amazing. Like, it was total Olympic wish fulfillment. Like, you see the Olympics on the TV, and even as a kid, you'd be like, maybe one day, maybe I'll just be an Olympic athlete. It would be amazing. But it's like everyone stayed at the team hotel. You go down to breakfast, you'd see team jackets from Thailand, Australia, wow. South Africa, Finland, Norway, Czech Republic, USA, everywhere was represented. And everybody there was so nice. Like, the spirit was just amazing. Everybody was congratulating everybody else. We had, you know, it was fully done. Like, you had to go into the warm-up tent and register before your event. You weren't allowed to leave. And so people were, like, doing laps in the heated warm-up tents. And just everybody was just really nice about it. Like, before the 5K, I actually tripped on a bit of the marquee, which loads of other people were tripping over too. Yeah, I bashed my knee against the concrete. And I was just in a little bit state of shock. And these two Finnish ladies were just there, and they just helped me up. And actually, it turned out one of them was competing in a lot of my track events, and we follow each other on Instagram now, so it's just really nice.
Oh, that's really lovely. Because it is an IOC event, an international IOC event, isn't it?
Yeah,
So you have won Olympic gold medals in my eyes.
Well, they're really nice medals, I must say. They're really nice and heavy and about, you know, the size of my palm. Like, they're good, hefty medals. And we got, there was proper podium as well, so they would call your name and you go up on the podium, you get handed a bouquet of flowers, the medal will go around your neck, you get a kiss on both cheeks by an Argentinian official, and it was just, it was wonderful. It was really nice. And the photos from the event, we had, Team GB had an official photographer that came along, and yeah, the photos are just spectacular. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because I think, I mean, there are over 1,000 athletes, aren't there, that go
from
44 countries.
Yeah,
it's
and the competition is actually really fierce in a lot of the events. There were a few of them, the women's 4x400 went uncontested just because a lot of the teams aren't really big enough and have that deep of a field for distance women. So, like, even in Team GB, we had to bring up quite a few of the sprinters. And also because, say my friend Ruth that I mentioned, she was competing in badminton at the same time, so there's schedule conflicts, so she couldn't do that one. So there were a few where it wasn't quite as strong a field, but especially for the 5K and the 1500, I think we had 19 women towing the start line for the 1500. So it's a scrum start, jockey for position in lanes one and two, and then kind of you just go for it.
Go for it. That
but,
is so cool.
Yeah, and as you said, it's an IOC event, but unfortunately we didn't get anywhere near as much funding as, say, the Olympics or the Paralympics. So I did have to fundraise to be able to go there. So all of the Team GB kit we had to buy, which was like £200, and then the flights were just £1,000 to begin with, and then the staying in the team hotel for the week, that was all inclusive, so all the meals and everything and the transport to and from the games venues and all that stuff. So yeah, I had really, really generous friends and family, and also my employers donated as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it was fantastic. Happily, the next games are in 2017 in Malaga, so a lot less distance to fly to get there. But also it hopefully will mean that I have a bigger cheering squad coming.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I would love to be there.
I hope we have a big mile 21.
Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah. So I think we've mentioned mile 21 in previous podcasts, but essentially in our running group, if you're not running, you're cheering. And at the London Marathon, or any marathon for that matter, everybody gets together at mile 21 and you just have this amazing carnival festival atmosphere that just encourages people to keep going. And it's just, I haven't actually been in the race, but I've been on the cheering side, and it's pretty awesome just to be on the cheering side. So I think probably when Melissa lined up any start line at these transplant games, people were probably quaking in their boots, because I think it was gold plus world record in the 1500, then gold 800, 400, 4 times 400 plus the team gold.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then obviously the 5K as well. So anything you entered was a pretty good result.
Well, the thing was that this was my first World Games, so people actually didn't know who I was, and they didn't know I was coming, because there was another Team GB athlete who normally takes all the golds. She had been the previous world record in the 1500, but she had been injured from the previous World Games and still hadn't quite gotten through it yet, so she wasn't up to being fighting fit just yet.
Okay.
And I hadn't actually met her until the British Games this year. We got on really, really well, so she was fine with me taking one of her world records. But because everybody saw that she wasn't coming, they thought, oh, the field is open. They didn't realise I was
going to slip in there. So under the radar, you came.
I haven't got that advantage next time, unfortunately.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens in that case.
It's more fun when there's people to play with.
Yeah, I guess, and it spurs everybody on. So I suppose it would be helpful to know why you're at the transplant game. What transplant did you have, and what did you go through, I suppose?
Yeah, so maybe even to take it back a little bit further, like, I started running just after I moved to London in 2002. You may have noticed from my accent, I'm not from around here. I'm originally from the States, and I moved here after university. And so, yeah, I started running in about 2002, and it was just, like, kind of on the gym treadmills to lose some weight, and I'd do some elliptical and do some weights, but, like, I'd only run for, like, 8-10 minutes. And I just remember they had personal trainers there at the gym that were, like, kind of included in your monthly fee. And I said, okay, I've only got 35 minutes. What should I do with it? Like, I want to lose weight. And he just looked at me and went, you should run for 35 minutes. He's like, what are you doing all this other stuff for? And I was like, oh, okay. So then I started to build up a little bit more on the treble. I don't even think I ever got up to that full 35 minutes. I still did some weights and stuff, but it kind of enforced into me that I should be running more. And I think it took years, and I think it was maybe for about, I think my first race was a 5K, I think in 2005 or 2006. So it was a few years before I even did a 5K. Mm. And I remember thinking, oh, I can never do a 10K. 10K is so far. I can never run that far. And then, of course, I did my first 10K in 2008. And
amazing.
I think I definitely attribute the fact that I've run for 13 years now, and I've run for 13 years without an injury.
Wow.
Mostly down to the fact that I only ran, I upped my distance very slowly and over a period of years. So I ran at the 10K distance for years and years before I moved up to a half marathon. I ran at that for years before I moved up to a marathon. And so if I had a penny for every person who says, oh, when are you going to run an ultra? When are you going to run an ultra? When are you going to run an ultra? I don't feel that I'm ready, and it's not that my time yet. I could go out and run an ultra, but I don't think that's a great decision for me. But taking it back anyway, so I had been running for, let's see, do the math, so it would have been about 6-7 years.
Mm.
And it was actually my running that kind of told me that something was wrong first. So I used to always do, I was so set in my ways that I would do the same loop, 10K loop. Mm-hmm. I go down the south bank of the river, cross Westminster Bridge, back down the north bank of the river, over Tower Bridge and home. So 10K loop.
Okay.
I do that 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Always on my own, always with headphones, always the same pace.
Routine is good sometimes.
I like routine. I'm so German in this. So I would do the same thing all the time. And I noticed, it was around about October time of year, I was like, oh, I'm feeling really sluggish. Oh, it's probably just the change in the clocks, you know, I'm just a bit off. And I started to notice that I was getting these burst blood vessels in the whites of my eyes.
Hmm.
And one came and went, and then another came and went. And I was like, something's not right. So I went to the optician and just said, oh, can you check this out? And they said, well, normally if you'd have one, it's not a big deal. Like, it's not even worth checking out, it just happens. And they said, but you've had a few, maybe you should go and have your blood pressure checked. I was like, my blood pressure is fine, like I've always been 120/80, like textbook.
Okay.
So they said, well, just go to your GP anyway, maybe they'll want to draw some blood, see if anything's fine there. So I went to the GP, they were like, yeah, fine, drew some blood pressure was fine. And it was like 2 days later, I think.
But no one's panicking at this stage. They're just like, oh, we'll just do some
panic is yet to come.
Okay.
2 days later, I get a call on my mobile from my GP going, you have to go to hospital right now. Absolutely. Drop everything. I'm like, I'm at work. No, go to A&E now.
Wow.
And I was like, oh. So I'm like freaking out. They said, your platelets are 50. And I was like,
What does that mean?
No, I actually didn't know what that means, because when I was 5 years old, I had a bone marrow disorder that they treated with, so this is 1984, like they didn't really do transplants then, and so they treated it with an experimental kind of thing involving horse serum. It worked really well, they said I'm cured for life, fine, go off, live your life. I hadn't even had a blood test in, God, I don't even know how many years, like it just,
okay,
it was just like,
genuinely.
Oh yeah, I almost died when I was a kid. Like, most of my friends didn't even know. It was just like, it wasn't really relevant to anything.
It's not funny. I'm smiling because it's such the way you say it. It's, oh yeah, I almost died as a kid, but I'm here, so, you know.
It's becoming relevant now, however.
Yeah.
Because I knew what platelets were, and I knew that platelets at 50 was a bad thing, and that when I was a kid, what I had with the bone marrow problem was an 80% death rate. So I'm sitting there on my way to A&E on the tube, trying not to cry, trying not to burst into tears, because I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to die. What's going to happen? What's going on? So I get to A&E. I have a large bar of chocolate in the 2 hour wait to see a doctor.
2 hours. That must have been a long 2 hours.
It's a very long 2 hours. And then I finally got to see the A&E doctor. She kind of went, okay. So she looked at the blood results that the GP had sent through. She said, yeah, they're low, it's not a big deal, your GP's an idiot, shouldn't be really freaking you out like this. What she should be doing is calling up to hematology. She pulls out the phone. Oh, hi, hematology, yeah, this is the deal, blah, blah. Okay, hematology, I'll see you next Wednesday, it's fine, don't worry about it. Yeah, it's low, but you're not in immediate danger of keeling over dead. And I was like, okay, that's kind of good, I'm a little talked down off the cliff. So, long story short, I went to hematology there. They kind of said, okay, well, the bone marrow failure is probably, we need to do some tests. We don't see this kind of thing very often, so we're going to refer you to one of the world's leading researchers.
Wow.
And specialists in the bone marrow disorders. In fact, the whole King's College Hospital, they actually have two, which is only, you know, down the road in Camberwell, so it's only a half hour kind of bus ride away. So really, really close by. I mean, because if I'd been in Glasgow or Wales or Ireland, they still would have referred me to King's.
Like, okay, so God,
just,
how
it's
lucky
just
that
fantastic
you're here.
That it's
yeah.
right down the road. Yeah. So that before Christmas, I saw this world's leading researcher, professor, and so it was really fast. It was, you know, 2 months, if that.
Okay.
I mean, when something is wrong, the NHS will absolutely pull out the stops and give world-class care.
Like, yeah, that's what I've heard.
Absolutely. And so she basically said, she was really fascinated by my case, because she said, normally, what I had had as a child in 1984, they said they now know only works for 5, 10, maybe 15 years.
So not a cure for life.
Well, in 1984, that was what they thought. But the fact that I had gone 25 years, they were very interested in. And they said that basically what happens is some people just have a genetic predisposition to certain triggers. So there are a few known triggers, but then the list just goes on and on and on and on. And then you can never pinpoint exactly what it was. Okay. But one of the known triggers is benzene, one of the really well-known ones. And that's a component in diesel and also paint and things like that. Right. So my parents think that it possibly could have been some paint that triggered me when I was 5. We have a couple of different things, because when we bought the boat, we had to mop up some diesel spill to avoid getting it on deck before it went into the water, to avoid getting an environmental fine. So I was up to my elbows literally in red diesel at one point. Another time we were grinding old paint off the decks, so I could have inhaled some paint.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so it could have been any one of those things, but it was really much of a muchness. And she said, well, what we also know now is that the treatment that you had when you were 5, that isn't going to work this time. So we need to do some more tests. And the tests are bone marrow biopsies, which are unbelievably painful. They basically drill into your hip bone and you can feel everything.
While
they pull out the marrow and you can feel it pulling up through your leg. It's genuinely excruciating.
Ouch.
And they can sedate, but I've found that the sedation doesn't work for me anyway. So
not helpful.
Yeah. So they have to do quite a few of those. They kind of work out. And this is kind of into January time. They decided, actually, you're going to need a transplant.
And so it's 2009, is it?
Yeah,
is
it's early 2009 now. It was the end of 2008.
Yeah.
So October time was when I noticed something was wrong, and now it's into January. So they had to check my brother, because in terms of bone marrow transplants, you need to get a really good match so you don't have rejection.
Yeah, okay.
So because you're getting a new immune system, you can't have your immune system reject your body. So they need to get as close as possible. And in that world, it's pretty much your siblings or the rest of the world. Like, your parents are only going to be a half match for you at best. And that's not good enough. So they tested my brother, and he wasn't a good enough match. He's my only brother. So then they had to put out kind of a search on the worldwide database. And for the UK, the Anthony Nolan Trust is the UK's bone marrow database. So they checked the UK. There wasn't anybody in the UK. But then they put out the feelers to the rest of the world databases. And luckily, in the US databases, there were, I think, 8 broad matches. So they test against, when you go on the database, they kind of store 3 or 4 different DNA marker points, which these days it's great. You just do a cheek swab, spit into a tube, post it. You don't even have to go to the doctor, don't even have to get blood drawn. It's so easy.
So actually, while we're on this, if people want to get on the register, because you have to be under 30.
Well, for the Anthony Nolan database, they had, if you're between the ages of 16 and 30, you can donate with Anthony Nolan, and I strongly suggest going to anthonynolan.org.uk. It's really not the painful process to donate that it used to be. Honestly, like, you just sit with a needle in one arm, needle in another, and it just centrifuge takes out the stem cells. Like, it's so easy. You just read a magazine or watch films and as an outpatient.
Okay, I'll put it
but
in
if you're over the age of 30, I've just found out that Delete Blood Cancer is a UK charity. They take donors up to the age of 55.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So if you're between the ages of 30 and 55, you can actually donate with them. So, yeah, go on to the Delete Blood Cancer website.
Okay, I'll put all of these things in the notes for the episode.
Yeah, so they found quite a few broad matches. And then what happens is that they get in touch with all the people in the database. So you need to keep your details up to date so they can get in contact with you. But, like, I think there were a couple that couldn't do it. Like, it might be that they're working abroad, or they're in the military, or maybe they're pregnant, like, or have other health problems and they wouldn't be able to donate. And then they basically call you back into the GP surgery, and they draw blood. So then they check at 10 points this time around. And out of the, 8 or so it was, I had 3 9 out of 10 matches, which is fantastic.
Wow.
And really, to put it bluntly, what that's down to is I'm white.
Okay, yeah.
Because there's a lot less genetic diversity in Caucasians than there are for, like, in one country in Africa. Like, there's so much genetic diversity in the rest of the world.
Okay.
And also because ethnic minorities are so underrepresented on the bone marrow database. We need a lot more minorities to come forward. And
really
just,
interesting.
Because you're only going to save someone from your own race.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense.
And so, yeah, I'm alive partly because I'm white, and that's horrible.
Yeah, I understand.
We need to do better. We need to have a donor out there for everybody who needs one.
And raise awareness, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before I'd met you, I don't think... I mean, I'd seen Anthony Nolan, I'd seen, you know, adverts on the tube or whatever as a charity, but I wasn't really aware of donation and going onto a register and things like this. So I think it's really important to raise awareness, because you're here because of that, as are others. And some others obviously sadly haven't made it because they haven't found a match, I suppose. So
yeah, and not finding a match, and then, I mean, that gives you... You don't have a chance at all if you don't have a match. Mm. There's only so long... Like, I honestly, without any melodrama, I wouldn't be alive.
Yeah.
Because by the end... by the time I had my transplant, I was getting 4 transfusions every single week.
Wow.
You can't keep that up. You reject it.
Yeah.
To try to describe what having low red blood cells feels like, you can't really compare it to jet lag. They're kind of different. But I think... I was thinking about this last night, and I think the most apt comparison is when you're running a marathon, and if you've ever hit the wall,
mm-hmm.
when your body starts to switch from burning glycogen to burning fat, and you feel really kind of spacey and lightheaded and not quite connected,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of what it felt like for 6 months.
Wow, okay.
And they give you, you get a transfusion, but it never gets you even close to normal levels.
Okay.
It's pretty much just enough to tide you over. So it's being chronically in that sort of state of depletion. And, I mean, I finally had the transplant in July of 2009, but that whole kind of time from January onwards, you know, I started with kind of a transfusion every other week. You know, reds 1 week, and then, you know, so maybe a month in between, because reds, and then 2 weeks of platelets, and then over, and like, it just got, I needed more and more and more, because I just wasn't making enough.
My goodness. So you had the transfusion itself the transplant itself went really well, is that right? But then the 6 months after that were pretty hellish.
Yeah.
Before you were able to kind of get back into normal life, I guess.
Yeah, so to describe what is actually involved with the bone marrow transplant. Mm. So, again, there's loads of logistics involved, because you have to get the donor to... You have a few small shots to kind of stimulate your body to produce a stem cell, so they need to start that a few weeks in advance.
Okay.
And they need to have hospital beds ready. So, I mean, the kind of data analyst in me just is going crazy about, like, you have to get so many things in a row, and then the transport, because my donor was in the States, so you have to fly, because it has a short shelf life, you have to fly the bone marrow stem cells over. So there's loads of involved there. And I had the transplant scheduled for May, and it was literally the day before, and they said, actually, we can't do it now, this problem. And my world was crushed. It was awful, because I was just literally hanging on. I kept being told, oh, okay, so it's going to be in April. And so I would try to hang on till April. April would roll around, there'd be a problem. So I was literally like, it was the day before I was meant to go in, and there's a problem. So, okay. And it ended up being, and I didn't know how long it was going to be, but it ended up being another month. So then this time around, I was like, okay, things might happen. It's okay, but hopefully I'll be in. And so I was admitted. And so the first 7 days, the first week that you're in the ward, and it's an absolute germ-free ward, because you have no immune system when you're in there. None. So, I mean, to the point that, well, you have your own room, you have your own ensuite there, because you can't get germs from any other person.
Mm-hmm.
It's too big of a risk. But they're so germ-free that actually the rooms are at, I think it's negative pressure, so that all the air flows out of the room when the door is open, rather than things from the corridor from other patients flying into the room.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't open the windows, things like that. And like, when people came to visit me, they had to scrub up outside. There's sinks outside every door. They had to wear the very fetching plastic apron, face masks, things like that. And the worst is I had to do this routine after every single thing that went in my mouth. So even if it was just a sip of tea, I had to brush my teeth, wash my hands, and it was like a series of three different mouthwashes.
Wow.
Like, to kill off all the bacteria. It was crazy. It was like, I just don't want to eat anything. Like,
yeah, I bet.
But so, sorry. So the transplant, the first 7 days is chemo. So you get a really intense blast of chemo. Some people also get total body irradiation. But basically, my case was that I had basically nothing left in my bone marrow to start. It was down to like 0.1% cellularity or something. It was ridiculous. So they didn't need to give me the irradiation, thankfully.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I had what was called a mini transplant. So it's slightly less chemo than you would normally get, but it's still like 10 times more than you get for, say, like breast cancer. Like, it's a lot of chemo. I had 7 days of chemo, and they told me going into the transplant, like for that month that I didn't think I was going to have, that month's delay, they said, okay, you need to gain weight, because everybody, the more weight that you have, you know, even though you were very fit before, mm-hmm. and I was probably the fittest person anyone knew, I was really healthy, I was running, I was lifting weights, eating organic food, everything. They said, you know, it's good that you've been really fit before, that'll help, but you need to put on weight because everybody loses weight.
Yeah.
Did I hell? I was the first person to gain weight on chemo.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. Now I have no hair and I'm fat. Thank you. Thank you, chemo. So, and then on the seventh day you rest, which is kind of quite apt. And then the day after that, you start the anti-rejection drugs and you get the stem cells. So that's day zero. So everything in your bone marrow transplant counts from the day you get the stem cells. Okay. So the first day that you're admitted is day -7.
Right.
-6, -5.
Yeah.
And then day zero is the day you get the stem cells, which is actually quite anticlimactic because you've been having so many IV drips.
Mm.
It's just another IV drip that just looks like guava juice. It was just pink. And you're like, okay.
But it's saving you.
And it's like a half hour and it's done.
Really?
Well, that, yeah, but that's... And then you have 3, 4, 5 possibly weeks of waiting for the stem cells to then find their way into your bone marrow and actually start producing cells again. So they give you some shots to kind of amplify what's being made in your bone marrow so they can see when it starts again.
Okay.
But it's really just a waiting game, and a waiting game to not get any infections, because that's what kills you. It's the infections.
Right. Okay.
Because you have literally no bone marrow. So you have to get loads of transfusions for the blood that you're not producing,
mm-hmm.
but most of it is just, you cannot get sick. You absolutely cannot. And there's so many germs and bacteria that just live naturally in your body. Things that are in your bones and reactivate, all sorts of things can kill you. So it was, it's just a waiting game. And I watched a lot of TV. I brought my sewing machine in with me, so I had a little
sewing machine.
I was making things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just talking to the nurses, because you can't really have that many visitors.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a lot of TV, but it was just boring. I didn't have... Yeah, I basically was in and out in 3 weeks, and normally they say a bone marrow transplant is 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow.
So I was actually, my hair didn't even start falling out until after I left the hospital.
Oh, right.
That was how quick it was. Because it takes... Yeah, I didn't know this either. It takes, like, 3 weeks for your hair to fall out from the chemo. Yeah. And then... Yeah, so I had the world's easiest transplant,
yes.
The doctors kind of said. And I was home for about 2 weeks. You did the shaved head thing. Everybody, I don't know, like, there's just so much focus on, like, losing your hair for chemo. But for me, it was like, it'll grow back. Even if I'm just sleeping, it'll grow back. Like, it was
quite
more...
a practical way to look at it, probably.
But I was more concerned about the body that I'd lost, because I was really fit. I had been doing loads of weights, and then to not be able to run for, it was, you know, like a year at that point. And that was my major stress relief. That was my, and also I put on weight from that anyway. And then them telling me to put on weight, I hate my glasses. I hate wearing glasses. It was just, it was more that I didn't think I would ever regain that fitness that I had. Because I knew, you know, I didn't have to do anything to get my hair back. It would just grow back of its own accord. But I would have to work my ass off to get that body back. And that was what hurt more.
And what were your... I suppose there are things that, I don't know, that you used at the time, like your coping mechanisms to try and stay positive. Because I think, I mean, it's similar with a lot of things in life. The mental game is really, really important. And are there things that you use in kind of everyday life that you learnt during that period that help?
I don't know. I mean, I was certainly not positive all the time.
Mm.
Not at all.
Oh, sure.
There was a lot of crying. like almost pretty much every day, because there's nothing you can do. You feel awful. You look awful. You don't want to do things, and it just wears you down. So like, I think actually the transplant itself was kind of easy to tick through. And when I was a little kid, when I was in hospital then, my mom's a teacher, and so she had like a bunch of other teachers and students bring in like just a little thing for me to open every day. And so this time around, I asked the readers on my website if, you know, they could send something in. It didn't have to cost anything. It could have just been a magazine where they had written something funny, or a few people emailed me just funny stories from their life. And so some of them were like kind of, you know, needlepoint kits or something handy.
So just explain what your website is quickly.
So my website is Fairtrade, F-E-H-R, which is my surname, T-R-A-D-E.com. It's a sewing site.
Yeah.
But cool. we'll get into the activewear stuff then later. But so for each of the days that I was in hospital, I had like a little thing to open. So that was kind of nice to mark the days and know that I was getting kind of closer to the end of and that was a process. I think what was a lot harder was after the transplant, as I said, I was home for 2 weeks and then I got readmitted into hospital. And they do tell you, they say nearly everyone has to go back in, like it's just part of the process. But I didn't realize that I was going to be in for 5 weeks, so longer than the actual transplant itself.
Yeah.
And so what I went in first for was, I was just having the worst headaches, and that was just like splitting, like couldn't stand up headaches. And that was just, the medication I was on, because you come home and I had something like 30 medications I had to take every day.
Okay.
Some of them were, because I had no immune system, many of them were just to handle the side effects of the other drugs.
Oh,
it's just like a big cocktail. It's just a huge amount of drugs. And so I went in for that, and I came back out, and then I got meningitis.
Oh my
god. Which is actually the second time I've had meningitis.
Wow.
And I'm just going to say that chemo is not even close to being in my top 10 most painful experiences. Meningitis both times occupy spots 1 and 2.
Oh my goodness. Gosh, so you came through that with a depleted immune system.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So that was just, I mean, that's luck. But also, the fitness that I had earlier, they still say, is one of the best things that saved me.
Wow.
Because
that's really
I was so fit, I was so strong before I went in, that you know, obviously I couldn't exercise when I had the blood problems, because I couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs, and just literally walking would just kill me for the rest of the day. But I did eventually get through, like, they said, you know, I had the easiest transplant, and then the first 6 months were some of the worst that you could possibly have, because I also had a liver infection on top of that. They thought that it spread to my lungs, so they had to do a general anesthetic surgery to check out my lungs to see if there's a fungal infection there. There wasn't, but the surgery from that was super painful. But the liver infections, anything with the liver takes so long to heal, long, like the time scales.
It's an organ that regenerates itself.
Yeah, but it takes
it?
A long time to do it. So anything to do with the liver takes a scale of months and months and months.
Okay.
So I had to get an antifungal IV drip every single day for 4 months, and I begged them to let me out of hospital. Begged them, because I just I didn't want to be there anymore.
It's miserable. It doesn't help you recover.
No, and the food had no nutrition in it. There was no nutritional value in the food whatsoever. Yeah. But then it was 4 months of my husband having to drive me back and forth to hospital every day, because I couldn't take a cab. I couldn't take public transport, because you don't know whether someone was coughing in it before
you.
You can't guarantee it. So we didn't even own a car before I was sick. So he had to buy a car. But then that obviously impacted his ability to work.
Yeah.
So it was just really hard 6 months. And then I got to kind of January 2010. So I'd had the transplant in July 2009, so it was about 6 months.
Yeah.
And that January was kind of like a little magic switch happened. So I kind of had just barely enough hair to do a pixie cut where it looked fine. I had these amazing Japanese cosplay wigs.
Right.
So I was just like, oh, I don't want some old lady chemo wig or like the horrible floppy hats that are like, I don't know, people who wear quilted art or something. I just didn't want that.
Okay.
I was like, I wouldn't wear that.
Find what's right for you,
I guess. Yeah, I was like, I wouldn't wear that when I was feeling my best. Why would I wear that when I feel crappy? No. Oh. So I bought these fabulous Japanese cosplay wigs. So like one was bright blue. I had a pink one.
I've seen a blonde
and a brunette, and then a bright red. And so I did enjoy wearing those out. But then like while I was around, I would just have like a little t-shirt type hat on. It's just because it's cold. Your head gets really cold. It's just for warmth. So I could ditch the wigs and just have a pixie haircut. And I also just started going back to work. So I did, like, first I think I did, like, 3 days a week. And then for, like, almost the next year, I did 4 days a week because it allowed me to do Monday and Tuesday at work, have a break on Wednesday, and then do Thursday and Friday. So it was, like, mini weeks, which really, really helped my work. Then were really, really understanding because it was a small company and I'd been there for years. So that was a huge, huge help as well.
Yeah.
So kind of January came around, I could take, you know, take the wigs off again, start work again. And I also was allowed to start wearing contact lenses again, which was a big part of my identity. I had a line, after they took out my Hickman line in my chest, they gave me one in the arm instead. But that one came out in January. And I could start running again. They gave me the okay to, you can go for a jog. So, I mean, I don't really have any memories of the very first run I ever went on in the gym, but I have really vivid memories of that first one that I did after the transplant because I had spent 18 months just every time a runner would go past me, just aching to run and really wanting that, but not being able to. And so when I did that first run, I didn't know how far I was going to be able to run at all. I knew it was going to be slow. It was cold. It was January. Who wants to run in January? True. It's crap in January. but I went out there and I ended up running 5K just off the bat.
Wow.
And so, like,
that's phenomenal.
When people say, oh, you lose fitness so quickly, I think I really only had been running 10K before I was ill, didn't run for 18 months and had a bone marrow transplant, complete immune system rebuild. But yeah, I could still run 5K at the end of it. Actually, I don't think fitness is lost that easily at all.
That's quite interesting. I think the mental side of that is really interesting as well. Because, I mean, you know, as we kind of alluded to earlier, I think getting through what you got through, I know it was really hard and difficult and really sad at times, but I'm sure there is an element of mental strength that allowed you to get through that.
Oh, absolutely.
And that, I think, I mean, in my experience, I can see that it definitely comes through in your running, but I wouldn't necessarily have known all of the story behind it. And so your 5K, I think for you it was like, well, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, well,
I want to do it.
I'm just so happy to be out here. I'll just do whatever and then build from there. But yeah, it's funny because in my family, like, there is no athletic prowess whatsoever. Like, nobody's ever been athletic. No one's ever been really fit. Like,
maybe
there's nothing.
They
nothing physically.
But they just don't know.
No, but there's nothing physical there.
Yeah.
But we are stubborn. We are. My mum used to say that I was the most stubborn child. She's so pig-headed, and I think it's brilliant that I found a sport where that's an asset.
Yeah.
I have kind of probably the best things that a distance runner needs: the ability to withstand pain.
Yes.
I've already proved that. And really, really stubborn.
Tick again.
Again, those are more important, I think, than any sort of genetic gifts that you might have as a runner.
So I suppose then, what? Because I know you did a few 10Ks, and I think you do one annually, don't you? In terms of sort of coming back to recovering, I guess. But how did running then play a part in your identity? Because I've never been through anything like you've been through, but that takes up a large part of your identity, I suppose. You know, you're recovering, that's what you're focused on, and that's who you are for a while. But then obviously you kind of, I guess, want to move on from that. And I'm
absolutely
quite interested in how you did that.
Absolutely. I kind of think of it like when you meet someone at a party that you've never met before, what are the things that they pick up on that they want to know about? And so for a long time, it was, I live on a boat, which still comes up at parties.
Which is still very cool,
I had a bone marrow transplant, and I sew. Those are the things that come up at the parties.
Yeah.
But I kind of, after a while, I kind of got, I don't mind talking about the bone marrow transplant. I don't mind talking about the boat or the sewing or those things, but it kind of gets a bit dull to be talking about those things all the time. And so, like, the bone marrow transplant was such a massive, it was my life. Like, that was my full-time job, was recovering.
Yeah.
That was all I could do. So once I got to the point where my goal, so you said, what were the things kind of that brought you through those dark times? One of which was the wedding. So we were engaged before I got sick. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be married in September 2009.
Yeah.
Transplant kind of put that aside. So we moved it by a year. So we got married in September 2010. So I had the wedding to look forward to and to plan.
Yeah, that must have been amazing.
And to sew my own wedding gown and just kind of go towards that. But there was also, I really wanted to do the 10K, a 10K race at my 1 year rebirthday, is what they call it.
Okay.
So there was, it was the Great British 10K is around the same time. Like early July was my transplant. So that was a little bit closer than Bupa, which is the one I prefer to do now as my kind of close enough rebirthday run. So I was really also looking forward to, okay, so I've got January until July. I'm at 5K from my first ever post-transplant run. I want to get up to 10K and run this. So I'm going to run it for the Anthony Nolan Trust as, and I did, I had 1 year post-transplant written in gold on my vest, on my back. And I had so many people on that run come up, pat me on the back, even as they were passing me, which is totally fine. Just like, great job. That's so fantastic. Like, keep going. Like, really good encouragement. And I did, so before my transplant, the 10K that I ran was, I think I ran it in 51 minutes. And yeah. I was really happy with that. Really really felt fast. And then the first year rebirthday 10K I ran in, I think it was 53 minutes. So not very far off at all. Yeah, so it wasn't very far off. But yeah, I just had a really good experience from that. And then it was like, okay, well, maybe next year, at the, you know, next year's 10K, I could take a little bit more time off. And I think it was that, it would have been, yeah, the second rebirthday run. I'd finished that, and I think I went down to, like, it was close. It was, like, 52 minutes or 51:30 or something like that. And I just kind of thought, what do I do now? Like, do I, you know, I really, I enjoy the running, but, like, maybe I should see if there's kind of something social out there.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of looking around for kind of running social networks online. And so I found Daily Mile, which nobody is really on anymore.
Okay.
But I had found, started following a couple people in London, and one of which was Chris Murdo, who is big in Run Dem Crew now. And I just saw him post this thing about, like, oh yeah, I went running with all these people and we ran through Liverpool Street Station. It was mental. And I was just like, that sounds like fun. I want to do that. And so I joined up the next week. And it's really funny because he had only joined that week. That was his first run that I had seen with the crew. And he had only joined because Steve Layton, who's another Run Dem crew member, had joined the previous week. So it was the three of us had all joined in a row. And still 4 years later, we're still running with the crew, which is amazing. And I think when I started going to Run Dem Crew, the transplant really defined me. And it was who I was, a large part of who I was. And I think Run Dem Crew really helped me to not only just meet new people, find new friends, but also to move my identity forward.
Okay.
And so that transplant will always be a part of me, but it no longer defines who I am. It, like, I've been able to overcome that, and, you know, I still have problems, health problems related to that, and I will for life.
Yeah.
But I'm able to push through that and kind of go, well, this is what I've learned from it. You know, I need to take things slow. I will always require more recovery time than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think the things that I've learned from the transplant are, like, some people might think, oh, you need to go out and do absolutely everything because carpe diem and you're not going to live forever. But I kind of see it opposite. Like, you need to really cherish what you have and you have to take care of it. Mm-hmm. And you have to play the long game. Like, recovery is a long game.
Yeah.
And so you have to think ahead and go, well, I'm not going to do 4 marathons in 1 year because that's a bit too much and I'm going to come out of the other side of that worse than when I started. Actually, I need to take a year out and I need to concentrate on my form or concentrate on my nutrition, and I'm going to actually go back and rebuild my aerobic base so I can burn fat as fuel rather than glycogen. And I need to change this foot strike so that I'm not putting a lot of pain on my joints. I'm actually going to build up the muscles around those joints so that my dodgy knees aren't a problem anymore. Mm. You need to put time into these things. You can't just bash out race after race after race every weekend.
Yeah,
well, I see people doing that and they end up injured in 6 months.
Yeah.
And I've already had enough time in my life where I haven't been able to run. I want to be able to run until I'm dead. I want to run until I'm 90.
Yeah.
I don't want to have 3 months of running and racing and then 18 months of being injured. I'm not going to do that. I've already had 18 months where I couldn't run. That's enough.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's really interesting that whole experience has made you a much more considered athlete and a considered runner. And it's, I find it really interesting sort of watching you and your running journey. So I think you've run 5 marathons, is it 5?
Yeah, 5. Yeah. And they've all been after the transplant, because before the transplant I'd only ever run 10Ks.
That's just phenomenal. Yeah. And that was one of your big things, wasn't it? Sort of getting to a point where you felt as strong or stronger than before.
Absolutely. Because as I said, like, losing my hair wasn't a big deal, but losing the body was. Mm. And I just, because I had just run that 10K, kind of 51-minute 10K time in 2008, just before I got ill, that was a really big kind of goal, like, to beat that pre-illness 10K time.
Okay.
And I think it took me something like maybe 3 or 4 years. Like, it was a big deal to get below that. And I'm just gonna say now my PB is 43 minutes. So yeah, I've gone like well beyond what I used to be. Like, yeah, so much faster than I was before I was ill. I'm so much stronger and I can run way, way longer.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal.
And I would have never even thought to do these things if I hadn't been part of a community of people where it's full of ordinary people. They are just ordinary people. There's nothing special about any of us there.
Mm-hmm.
But to see ordinary people doing absolutely extraordinary things week in and week out makes you think, why not give that a try?
Exactly.
I mean, they can do it. They've got a full-time job. They've got all these problems. They can work around it. Like, yeah, why don't I try a marathon? Why don't I try a half marathon? Why shouldn't I go and devote myself to this?
But I think what's really amazing about you is that you seem to be so motivated and your running has just gone from strength to strength. So, I mean, I can't remember the years. I looked at your times, I think between, correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay, if I can remember.
So you did the Copenhagen Marathon in May 2013 in a time of 3 hours 52.
Yeah.
And then the following year,
before that, though, I had Amsterdam was my first.
Yeah.
And I did that in 3:48 in 2012. Yeah.
Yeah. So slightly longer time in Copenhagen. So 3 hours 52.
That was because I just come off. I had had shingles. For 6 weeks.
Ouch.
Basically, the doctors had said that, in January 2013, the doctors had said it was the worst case they'd ever seen, like in real life or the internet. Like,
oh my goodness, because it's quite a common thing, so that is quite major.
Yeah, because the transplant took out my entire immune system. I basically, from the end of that, I had the immune system of my donor as a baby.
Oh.
So you have none of the accumulated coughs, colds, everything. So I literally picked up everything, and I had to get all my childhood immunizations all over again. And I had chickenpox as a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
But they actually gave me the chickenpox vaccine again. But obviously,
okay,
I still had the antibodies. I got shingles because I am that lucky. And it was it was my entire left side of my torso, from my chest all the way down to my waist.
I've not had it, but it just makes
it lasted. It was chronic pain for several months. Like, I was supposed to run Paris half that year in March, and I was still on too many medications that were pretty hardcore at medications, and they said no, absolutely not. So so hence me running Copenhagen Marathon in May of that year at all was a
wow.
I just want to point out, in that particular, in Copenhagen Marathon, I learned that taking walking breaks is not the end of your race. It is really not a big deal. Because I think we all build ourselves up to be like, even when you do like a 5K, you're like, I'm going to run the whole way.
Yeah.
And if I walk at all, that means I'm a loser and I might as well just quit now. It's like, no, in that race, actually, my hips were starting to ache, a little off cobbles, and my knees were, and because I hadn't had the training that I should have had for that race because I'd been so ill.
Yeah.
I did have to take a few walking breaks, and it was just kind of 10 seconds, 30 seconds here, just me going, it hurts just as much as we walk. We might as well run. Let's go. but yeah, I learned something from every single marathon I've done. And that was the take home from Copenhagen.
Oh, I think that's really cool. But anyway, so 3:52, I think, is still a pretty good time.
Yeah.
But from, May 2013, 3:52, to the London Marathon in April 2014, 3 hours 30.
Yeah.
So you knocked off 22 minutes in the space of a year.
Do you want to know what happened in that year?
Go on, please tell me.
That was the year I took out to relearn how to run. And that was probably the best investment I've ever had in my future health and in my running, especially running performance. Because I was a heel striker, which is no bad thing. I mean, plenty of people heel strike. And as I said, I'd never been injured, so it wasn't an injury thing of me going, oh, I really need to relearn how to run. But it was just more of a, I feel like I'm putting a lot of effort in and not getting enough gains back. Like, I think that I could be a lot more efficient in my running style. And so I joined up with my coach, who I still train with now, Barbara, at Energy Lab. Mm-hmm. And we just basically started from scratch. So still with the same kind of really thick running shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, not Hoka, but, you know, stabilized everything running shoes. We just said, okay, well, we start with cadence was the first thing. So increase your cadence. So quick little steps, still heel striking, quick little steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then we worked on the gravity. So you kind of lean forward, like you're about to fall, and mm-hmm. naturally your feet move underneath you. So your strike is kind of going to more of a midfoot. So quick little feet running forward. And then we worked on kind of lifting your knees up and moving all that. And then finally, you know, because I wouldn't be able to keep that up because my muscles weren't used to that for a whole 10K run. So mm-hmm. I would only do that for about 5K or however long I could last and then fall back onto the old heel striking. Mm-hmm. So it was important that I was still wearing my thick shoes for that.
Yeah.
And then gradually, kind of over the course of a few months, I was able to do that longer and longer. And I think it was, I just posted about this last night. Bacchus half marathon I'd done the year before and really enjoyed. It's a really hilly half marathon. It also is fancy dress and wine
Where
tasting.
Is it?
It's in the Surrey Hills, so it's really close to Box Hill. So it's very up and down.
Yeah.
And my goal, that was in September of that year, and I thought, okay, well, my goal for that is I want to get a podium place at this race, because I was like fifth or sixth lady the year before without even trying, and I was like, okay, let's go. But it is a quite fast field, and it's a really technical hilly trail race.
Yeah.
And so that whole year we were kind of building towards, okay, let's get the strength up. I had been running, my knees have always been dodgy, mm-hmm. always. My mom has bad knees, but also I had a skiing accident when I was in high school, which took a lot of the cartilage out. So I'd always run with a knee brace,
mm-hmm.
But kind of relearning how to run, being more efficient in my form and my gait, where I hold my whole body and core as well, meant that I build up enough of the muscles that I don't need to wear the knee brace all anymore. I mean, I still don't have any cartilage in my knees.
Mm.
That hasn't changed. It's not going to change. But the fact that everything else is stronger to support it meant that I could go into this trail race. I absolutely worked my ass off on that. I mean, the photos, I'm just like gurning.
I think I remember, actually.
I was really, And I got third place, so
that
I got my podium place out of that.
Amazing.
So, it's just, being able to take that year off and make that an investment in my future just felt like the really right thing to do. And it was a year, I say a year, but I mean, it's kind of 2 years on from that now, and my feet have only just been able to get strong enough that I don't get blisters, like horrific blisters every time I run.
But
they're finally strong enough that I can grip, and I've moved from minimalist shoes down even into barefoot shoes now.
Really?
Yeah. And I could feel the total difference. Like, I used to think they were about the same.
Yeah.
Total difference between minimalist and barefoot. Barefoot, there's nothing there, but like, you can totally feel like my feet feel like they've had as much of a workout as my legs or my arms or my lungs when I get back from the end of the run. I'm like, that's what running's supposed to feel like.
I think that's pretty phenomenal. But during this time, so obviously, and actually, you know, what I was going to say is that I think a lot of us, it kind of goes back to what you said earlier, but a lot of us just want results quickly.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to be really impatient, but I think what you've just said just really clarifies the fact that it's worth taking the time to build up your endurance, to build up, you know, sort of your core strength, your muscular strength, so that you do have more endurance.
Absolutely.
And then you limit those risks of injuries, which runners are particularly renowned for, I think. So during this time, during these few years of kind of training for marathons, various different races, I think you also started your own business.
Yeah.
So not busy at all.
As if marathon training isn't enough. Yeah.
And having a job.
Yeah, and a full-time job, yeah. So around the same time that I moved to London, when I started running, I also started sewing. So I got a sewing machine from my sister-in-law, brought it across the Atlantic. It's still my main machine. It runs through a voltage converter.
Wow, okay.
And I've pretty much taught myself to sew everything. I'm wearing some jeans now. I made these, winter coats, swimsuits, ball gowns. My wedding gown. I've pretty much made everything. And it just starts from, I think my first project was like, here's a big t-shirt I got for free. I want to make it smaller and fit me. Just basic. And then I'll go, the next project has a zipper in it. How do I do a zipper? Let's look up on the internet how to do a zipper. And there's so much more out there now than there was when I started to learn how to sew. And so kind of if you do that for 10, 13 years, you kind of get good at it. And so with more of this running, I was losing weight. My body was changing because I was getting more muscular. And, like, running gear is so... Again, it's getting a little bit better now, but it was all black and pink.
Okay, and yeah.
Not great, and it would fade, and, like, it just wasn't... Like, that's not me when I run. Like, my style when I'm in kind of normal everyday wear is quite minimalist. I prefer solid colours or greys, and I like to mix up textures and seam lines for mm-hmm. a bit of interest. When I'm running, I really want bright colours, loads of bright patterns, and especially, like, 2-3 years ago, there was none of that out there. It's, like I said, it's getting a lot better now that there is more choice out there. But still, like, every woman I've talked to with running, even with something as simple as a pair of leggings, mm-hmm. say either they're too long, they're too short, not enough bum, too much bum, they move, they haven't got a pocket. All of these things can be easily fixed when you sew your own. And I was realizing that in the sewing pattern community, there was one in particular really, really good activewear company. They tend to specialize more in ice skating things. Mm-hmm. They had a couple of running patterns. But it was loads of basics. There were a lot of basic patterns out there, but nothing that kind of had interesting style lines or, like, say, one of my first pattern was just a running top that had a built-in bra that actually worked. Because you buy them in the shop and it's like this little shelf thing and you're like, well, I still have to wear a sports bra underneath it because this doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
So that was one of my goals, is to make one that actually worked. And it's not that hard, but you just have to know your body enough to tweak it and kind of do the mesh this way and the mesh that way. And so I'd been made redundant from my tech job that I'd had for 12 years at the end of 2013. And I thought, well, all these things that I could do, let's give this a try. Let's try. So I started my activewear sewing pattern company, which sounds very niche if you're not in the sewing world.
Yeah, and you even see somebody as ignorant as me, we've had this conversation before, I'm like, yeah, you see, I wouldn't even think that something like that would exist, but then there's loads of things that you don't think would exist.
You would be amazed how many people want to sew their own activewear. And also, because people see that I am running in my own designs, I know what I'm doing, I'm testing them, I actually work out in activewear. And I know that sounds weird, but so many places and people who design these things don't test for movement. They test for... Yeah. Okay. I was just actually reading an article today about how to manufacture a small amount of leggings. And so this is how you do the tech pack and the design, and then you get a fit model and then you do this. And it was like, there was a sentence in there that was like, sometimes we even get our fit models to run in them. And I was like, you're releasing running leggings and you're not testing them by running? What's wrong with you? But that's how the industry works.
But surely
they're meant to
look
good while you're standing still. And so for someone to go, actually, you shouldn't have a seam line here because it creates chafing. You want this pocket to be this way because it's not going to bounce. These things are kind of basic to a runner, but not necessarily to...
designers.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't think that would happen for swimwear or something. Like, you'd have to test swimwear in a pool.
Well, you'd hope so,
maybe not.
So I've had, I'm actually just celebrating the second anniversary of Fairtrade Patterns.
I've
got 10 sewing patterns out there, 9 of them for women, 1 for men. I've got a freebie as well, which is like just a little running arm pouch.
Which is brilliant.
And that was part of my fundraising for Argentina, was selling those.
They're brilliant. So you can hold your mobile phone, you can hold all kinds of things, little bits of food.
And you can make
need keys.
You can make one for free. Yeah.
Even more amazing.
And I think a lot of my designs also are meant to use up little small fun scraps of fabric. So one of the shirts I made recently used a bunch of old race shirts that we got given for free, and I wore it to Rundem this week, and I had so many people going up and going, that's Run to the Beat. I recognize Run to the Beat in your shirt. Oh my God, did you make that from an old shirt? And I just went mental for it. But that's the kind of thing. Like, I'm so used to wearing my own designs and running in them. I couldn't go back to shop-bought.
Well, you have
activewear.
Bespoke tailoring for yourself.
Yeah, but
so,
it's really
brilliant.
Not a difficult thing. Like, I teach sewing classes as well. And so I've taught a lot of people to make their first pair of leggings.
Oh, fantastic.
And so you take the pattern home, you pick out your own fabric, and it's just so easy, and you can just go to a sewing cafe and use their machines. You don't even need to have them on your own.
Yeah.
So, and once you get you know, the first one you might need is a few tweaks here and there to get it the way you like it. Do you like high rise, low rise, that kind of thing? And then once you've got that sorted, it's really like, you can crank them out for 20 quid each, 30 quid each. It just depends on what fabric you're going to buy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have full control over the whole process, I guess, which is fantastic. So at what point did you get involved in the British Transplant Games? How did you get involved in that?
Well, at first, there was a bit of a false start there, because I think it was while I was having this, I had that liver infection, so I was up in the liver unit. At one point, because they wanted to check me over, and I saw there was a poster up on the wall of the outpatients up there, and it said about the transplant games. I was like, oh, I took a photo of it on my phone and kind of got in touch. And at that point, they said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I know it says transplant, but it's only for organ transplants." I was like, oh, okay. And then it was like another year or two after that they had a poster up in hematology, and I thought, okay, they must be taking bone marrow transplant patients now if they've put it in hematology. So I got in touch with them, and they were really happy to have me on the team. And so I went to my first transplant games was, it was in Sheffield in 2013?
I think it
was 2013. So that was my first. You've been doing the research more than me. As if
I know more than you do.
So it was the first games, and I turned up, and I was really like, gear in for this competition, and the lady who had been winning all of the gold medals, she was very recently injured at that point, so I was all like gearing up for a fight. I was like, I know what her times are, and I'm gonna go for these, and she's not gonna know I'm coming. It was all this kind of game, and then she wasn't there, so I just like blew the competition out of the water, and I felt a bit bad
again.
But then King's, because you compete for your hospital at the British Games.
Oh, okay.
So everybody's hospital has a team, and so King's College Hospital is where I had my transplant, so that's the hospital that you compete for. They were just like, oh, you're quite good at this running thing. Would you like to come and compete with us for again? In fact, you're not doing enough events. You need to do the maximum five next year. And then it was off the performance at the British Games that I was selected for the World Games for the British team then.
So that's a selection process then.
Yeah, so they look at, they're basically, there's not a set time that you need to get, but they look at your times from the last two games and kind of what your times were and what your kind of medal potential will be. So they kind of compare it against what the field was at the previous World Games, and kind of, they need to get medals. Like the British Games are just amazing because there are so many people there who have had unbelievably hard times and are just walking. Like just walking 100 meters is just, oh my God, standing ovation. Like,
it must be,
and
so
there's
inspiring
kids there as well. Oh, absolutely. Because every single person competing was saved by a donor, and a lot of the organ transplantees, their donor died. Somebody had to die for them to live.
Wow, yeah.
And so they are just so grateful to the families that let that happen. And there are other people where the donors are there, say for the kidney.
Oh, really?
Donors. Yeah, there's actually a donor relay. So the donors are actually doing a relay race around. And so, like, the atmosphere is just absolutely incredible. Like, competitions are, they're all open to the public, you can just go.
Okay.
It's in Liverpool in July this
year. Right.
Sorry, 2016, this upcoming year. And you can just go. But at the World Games, it's more of a focus on competition. It is, okay, like, so they want to make sure that you might be able to earn a medal for Great Britain. So it's kind of, they look at what you could be doing.
That's really, I think that anything like that, I think I'd probably spend my time crying. Even when I watch a marathon, I just find watching things like that as well, it happens when I participate in them as well, because there's just people that have been through so much and have so many different types of experiences, and there's, as you said before, like you had, you know, your kind of story noted on your t-shirt, and it's just amazing what people come through and then the achievements that they make afterwards. I just think is absolutely phenomenal. So I suppose what's next, in a way. So I know you've got some pretty exciting names. And the other thing is, what I find interesting is that you have quite a kind of strategic way of planning your years. So you do actually work for an A race usually, don't you?
Yeah.
And then have other races around it.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I can really do like 10Ks or half marathons without too much thought. I can just do those sort of training where I don't really train for those these times. Yeah, what's next? So the other thing about being strategic is that I need to plan around my years around the British Games, which are always kind of in July, August.
Okay.
And then now the World Games are every other year, so I need to kind of plan around those as well. So the nice thing is that 2016 isn't a World Games year, so I can be a little bit freer to do some other races. Like, I've been wanting to do a trail marathon for a long time.
Mm.
So next year, I haven't got anything for the end of this year. I'm kind of in the off season. I'm just about to start marathon training. So I've got London Marathon again.
Okay,
super. I'm thankful enough that I've got a good for age place, so I can pretty much get into
speedy
that now.
Times.
Well, it's my local marathon as well. It comes down the end of the road.
True.
I run past home at halfway. It's brilliant. So I'm doing London Marathon in April. I think I might squeeze in Hackney Half just as a party pace run.
Hackney's in London as well.
Yeah, Hackney Half is in London as well. But it's 2 weeks after London Marathon. So
oh, is it really?
Yeah, they moved the day and it's not quite as convenient if you run London Marathon now. But I understand it's better for the weather. It's less likely to be brutally hot.
True.
And then in June, which is actually 6 weeks after London Marathon, I've signed up for the Transylvanian Bear Run. It's a marathon distance and an ultra, so I'm doing the marathon distance because I've been wanting to do a trail run for ages. And it's a run through the last unspoiled forests in Europe.
Wow.
And you end going up the steps to Dracula's castle.
Wow.
And the whole thing is just brilliant. Like, they include all the transfers from the little airports in Romania, your accommodations included, post-race party. I've heard that apparently you get given schnapps on the start line, so I'm doing London Marathon for a time. The Transylvania Bear Race is for fun.
So is London the A race?
London's the A race,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
And then I've got the British Transplant Games in July, at the end of July.
Yeah.
I might, the European Transplant Games are in Finland.
Okay.
In the summer. I'm still deciding. I may go out for the weekend and do those. I'm not so sure. My newly found Finnish friend is trying to convince me to go out.
It'd be fun. I'd imagine it'd be fun.
Yeah, but track stuff. I'm not built for track. I'm not built for these speed events.
I suppose, do you think you can carry your training through from the British one without doing too much extra?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't relish track training. I really enjoy long runs. And, like, I like that in a marathon I can just kind of coast for 2 hours and then have to start thinking about racing.
Would see it like that.
5k is just painful from the first step.
I agree.
Whoa.
And the shorter distances that you do on the track, I mean that's lactic acid
heaven.
Oh
my gosh. The 1500 is different, because the 1500 is it's like a chess game.
Okay.
You got to think about, like, which lane you need to be in for, like, and then you can start to play mind games, and then it's lap three where the fun starts.
Okay.
Everybody falls away in lap three, so you need to, like, hang in there and put your push in at three, not at four.
So there's proper
1500 is fun. Like, anything shorter than that is just full out brutal. Just run. Yeah. Just run as fast as you can, you idiot. Just run.
As if something's chasing you, just go.
Like a bear.
Yeah.
I need to not do that in the bear race.
Yeah, true. Now, that sounds like a really, really phenomenal race. But I guess what I'm interested in is what really drives you and motivates you now? Because you are always going for these faster times, and I do always sense real strength and drive there. And I just wonder kind of what it comes from.
I think from especially for my A races, I want to do my best.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best that I can do? And I feel I've gotten really good times from the marathon, but I think my best time is still ahead of me.
Okay.
And having talked to various people who don't have any sort of reason to flatter me for any reason, like, there's no point. I think that I can at least get somewhere in the early 3 hour. I think I can get into that territory.
Amazing.
It's just whether my training comes together, whether I'm able to fit it around everything else, life, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And whether the weather is good on the day, because you can train, you can have perfect training. You can be so strong, you can be so ready, and if you line up on the start line and it's, I don't know, 25 degrees and high humidity, you're not going to do a good race. So
or you can just have an off day.
Yeah, or just have an off day.
It's so strange.
Yeah.
The body does strange things, and even if everything's gone perfectly. And that's just about readapting your expectations on that day.
Yeah, and I think that's some of the allure of the marathon, is that you... 10K, if it doesn't go well, you can just go out and do another one the next week. But, like, a marathon, there's so much build up there, and there's so much... Like, I have to take at least a month to recover after a marathon. Like, I can feel... And I one of the most important training tools that I use is knowing my resting heart rate. So I know what my normal resting heart rate is, and if 3 weeks after the marathon it's still elevated before I get out of bed, and you know, there's apps that can just, you just stick your finger over the phone camera and it just measures it, and if it's 10 degrees or 10 beats elevated, I know that I'm still not recovered. It's easy as that.
Okay, so you really pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen to the cues from your body.
I suppose I'm just trying to think if anybody wanted to had been, I suppose anybody who's been through something like you, who's had a serious health issue, what would your advice be to start building confidence and getting back into the activities? And not, I mean, I suppose in this instance it's about sport, but I guess more general than that.
Yeah. I think I'll take that in two parts. I think my advice for anyone is that be as fit as you can possibly be. Because that is what saved my life. You never know. Like, this came out of the blue. You can't go, oh, well, I've got diabetes now, or I've got heart disease now, or I'm going to get fit now. No, you have to be fit in order to withstand things that are going to be thrown at you. But I think if you're coming out of something, cancer diagnosis, or a organ transplant, or any kind of major health problem, I think... there's nothing out there. I mean, there isn't no kind of, like, I looked for advice for recovering from chemo for runners.
Yeah.
There's nothing. There's so many things, recovering from surgery, recovering from pregnancy. God, there's a million posts out there about after your baby, this is how you run. But there's nothing for chemo. And, I mean, I didn't have cancer. I had something different, but I had the exact same treatment as someone who would have lymphoma or leukemia, I think, something like that. And I think just start small. Start with something you enjoy. And the same as anyone who's starting exercise, is make it a habit. You don't have to go fast. You don't have to go far. Just make it a habit. Even walking. Even just like, okay, well, I'm going to walk to work or home from work 3 times a week. Or I'm going to walk the dog every morning. It doesn't... make it a habit.
And it's kind of taking that step and then moving forward. It's that forward momentum, isn't it? So that you can sort of move on from what you've been through.
Because that kind of confidence that you gain from that will just affect your life in so many different ways. And when you see success in anything, kind of exercise or athletics, it will reflect on other areas of your life. I would have never had the confidence to start my own business had I not done all these things and had all these kind of successes in running. Never would have had that.
I love that. And I also, right at the beginning of this conversation, you said that when you started running, you'd never have thought you'd have been able to do a 10K.
Yeah.
And now you've been to kind of international games, you've done marathons. And I guess with all of those different stages, there's this, oh, I'm taking on another thing, it's a bit scary, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And my husband, he's a cyclist. He's not a runner. And he was umming and awing about whether he should do the Dunwich Dynamo, which if you're not from London, you probably don't know it, but it's an overnight cycle ride from London out to Dunwich on the Suffolk coast. I think it's 100 some miles. Really long. It's overnight in the darkness, and it's completely, I wouldn't say unorganized, but it's not owned by, it's not an event put on by somebody. It's just people know that on this day of this year, you rock up on your bike at this place and you set off whenever you like. And he is a cycle commuter, but it was just like a much longer distance. Like 3 times longer than he'd ever done, and he wasn't quite sure. And I just said to him, like, you should do something that scares you. Like, you should, if you're feeling like that pit of the stomach, oh, I'm a bit nervous about this. And I do it at the beginning of every marathon. I feel a bit sick.
Yeah.
I think, what am I doing? What am I in for again? Like, you should have that. And that's what's going to spur you on. If you're not doing that, you're not challenging yourself.
Yeah.
And you don't have to challenge yourself all the time. Like, you need an off season, and you need some races that you need to think, oh, I'm just going to do this one for fun, or I'm going to run with my friend for this one, or I just want to have a good time. That's fine. But you need to have those kind of A race challenges that kind of push you a little bit further. And he did Dunwich, and he did it in a way faster time than he thought he was going to do, and he loves it, and he can't wait to do it next year as well.
Yeah, but that's what's so exciting. I think that's a lovely, lovely point to end on. Thank you so, so much. I think it's been really fascinating. Obviously, you run distances between 400 metres and a marathon, which is pretty unusual.
It's a range.
And you seem to win medals at every distance as well, which is also super. And you've been through so much and achieved so much as well. And I just think it's super inspiring. So
thank you very much. It's been so nice talking with you as well. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope that you enjoyed listening to Melissa's story. It certainly inspires me to go out there, push my own limits and really live beyond. I just really think that her courage, strength and real determination are just a huge inspiration. And knowing Melissa, she's very understated about things, but she really does have an inspiring story. Her websites and the charities that she mentioned are in the notes to the episode on the Live Beyond website, so www.livebeyond.co. As usual, the next podcast will be up in the next few weeks. So again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.